Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. Thank you for indulging me to ramble for 45 minutes about laws and legislation, and even thank you for pretending to be interested in that. Very nice of you to be here. So before I start, I want to take a moment of expressing my gratitude towards the organizers of this awesome conference. As a conference organizer myself, I actually was project lead for Open SUSE Conference 2015 in The Hague. I know how much blood, sweat, and tears literally goes into this kind of thing. So first thing, if there is anyone from the organization here, then they will hear it, and if not, they will see it on video. Please give the organization of this conference a round of applause. And this also was a test to see if you are listening and awake. Thank you. So, let's move on then. So, who am I? My name is Hans de Waard. It's not Robin, sorry, that's a typo in my slides. Robin is a very good friend of mine, and we do presentations together, so that's why his name turns up here. I'm Hans. I've been working in IT and IT security for about 20 years by now, so yes, I'm that old. My target areas of business are primarily heavily regulated environments like governments, medical and healthcare institutions, the type of business that whenever something goes wrong, either someone has to pay a lot of money, or someone, and this I find personally much more scary, or someone gets hurt, because especially in healthcare, information integrity, confidentiality, and availability is literally what is the difference between, or can be the difference between life and death. But to keep the atmosphere a bit lighter than life and death, I also do other stuff. I organize classical concerts, I have a classic Mercedes-Benz, and I grow my own wine grapes, because everyone needs a hobby. But let's not ramble on too much about me. Why are we here? Why are we here in this room? There is a paradigm change going on in European law. We are moving from a construction where laws are typically descriptions of what you are not allowed to do, towards models that outline general guidances of compliance and general methodology to implement measures to mitigate risks. And where does that come from? Well, we are in an era of change. Our current times no longer allow for lawmakers to be overly specific when it comes to certain technologies, when it comes to certain economic models, when it comes to, well, basically anything that was an unmovable truth almost 20 years ago, by now has become moving, and especially as the world somehow appears to be bigger than Western or Eastern Europe, you need to implement laws and regulations that are not only culturally applicable within a certain continental realm, but can be used as a global, universal type of methodology. So, but first, let's make sure that we talk about the same thing here, because I'm going to talk about cyber stuff. So what is cyber? Well, cyber is literally nothing. Cyber is coming from the ancient Greek term, which means being able to basically control, push, or make something happen. So how does that relate to cybercrime, cyber sex, and other types of cybers that we have nowadays? Hail to all the cybers, it doesn't mean anything. What it does mean, however, is that somehow a lot of people seem to think that it actually means something. So because a lot of people think that it actually means something, I'm going to pretend that I am one of those people who actually think it means something, because else it would take me too much time to move out, get out all of those cyber references, and come up with another marketing term for this whole container thingy. So where does this come from? Or at least where does the cybersecurity strategy that we now see developing, where does that come from? A couple of things. First of all, laws and technologies don't necessarily complement each other. Maybe this is a bit of a stretch, but open source software and economic business models, they're also not entirely directly related. They tend to exist perfectly happy in each other's vicinity, yet being able to sell something that is free kind of like is a contradiction in terms. What you need to do when you want to sell something that is free is you have to focus on the circumstance around that particular aspect. And then you have to come up with methodologies and procedures and with value-added regulations to ensure that the component that you are selling, even though it is free, becomes economically attractive from a different perspective. And that is actually what the cybersecurity strategy is all about, because cybersecurity is a term, is a concept that is A, meaningless, B, undefinable, and C, well, is there even a C necessary? But what is valuable is information. What is valuable is the raw data. From the raw data, we create information by correlating raw data into entities, relations, and whatnot. From information, we create knowledge. And based on this knowledge, we take decisions as a society. Believe it or not, even politicians tend to think that they are influenced by actual knowledge. And one of the things that I see happening nowadays is that, although this is maybe hard to believe nowadays, laws actually go above technology. And yes, of course, there is technological opportunity to keep certain information out of the realm of authorities. For instance, encrypted communication ensures that you are able to communicate with other people without governments intercepting your communication. Yet still, if a law in a country decides, or at least defines, that at some point in the judicial system, you should be able, or the government should be able, to break into your systems, consequences be damned, well, that will happen. Luckily, we are in Europe, and Europe has, at least since about 75 years ago, a pretty good track record of keeping privacy, or citizen privacy, as one of its core competences. And I know when I'm saying that, where I'm standing right now, 30 years ago, in this particular city, for instance, that type of liberty and that type of privacy was not yet taken for granted. So privacy and laws and technology are, well, let's say, interestingly not entirely compatible concepts. Yet, what you see is nowadays, I don't know, who has seen Mark Zuckerberg testify or promote himself in front of the European Parliament recently? Who of you has seen that? A couple of people. Well, me too. So what I found interesting there is not necessarily the whole marketing show and the whole circus that was put up around that. But what I found interesting is the actual fact that the European Parliament called him over to question him. And what I also found interesting is the response of several of the parties in the European Parliament, as in that they have been profoundly dissatisfied with the level of answering that Zuckerberg provided, and that they will follow up. So that is interesting from a point of view that you now see politicians not only taking an interest, but also seemingly taking responsibility to gain the knowledge needed to actually understand the concept and do something with it. Well, that's the same thing that's happening, or has been happening actually, on a cybersecurity realm since about the early 2000s, when we had the first more or less globally accepted certification evaluation scheme for IT security-related audits and assessments, the common criteria. That was around 2000. That has been devised and updated in 2014. And that's basically what we're going to talk about now. But still, what we see in the European Union, same as with the GDPR, before the GDPR, countries regarded information security and information or privacy information security as being a national thing, somehow with the premonition that the internet would stop at their borders and that parties wanting to exchange in international trade or international data sharing or exchange would gladly implement geofencing or whatnot to do that. Well, that somehow magically didn't happen. And especially companies like Google or Facebook or the usual big suspects, they're not going to. You have to approach this as a continent, I would say. And what we see nowadays is, on the cybersecurity approaches, there is a very nationally focused approach. So what will happen now is that the European Commission is drawing up a new regulation towards a harmonized model for information security, cybersecurity, incident response, training, education, and whatnot. But what I find the most interesting goal and objective in this is the one that I've outlined here, and especially the latter one, is it is the explicit goal of this regulation to ensure transparency of cybersecurity assurance. And assurance means being able to validate and evaluate if a security measure or control has actually been implemented in any way that ensures its effectiveness. Because, well, assurances without control, that's basically what the religious domain is all about, and that's, for instance, in the cybersecurity domain, stay out of the religious domain. And the other thing, and this I mentioned briefly before, is we are going from a model where laws dictate what is forbidden to a model where laws create a compliance realm or compliance domain in which, as a company or individual, you have then to perform proper risk management and impact assessments to prove your compliance with that specific legal domain. And I would say that this is an enormous plus, because before we had compliance with IT security laws was being placed under the legal departments of companies. And, well, a lot of my friends are lawyers. Yes, they are. But their primary competence area doesn't necessarily lay in the IT realm. Their primary competence area is primary in the business of explaining, no matter what is the reality, that they are somehow compliant to whatever alternative reality is being described by the law. So what happens now, and that is the same thing with the GDPR, for instance, is GDPR is not an IT law. GDPR is also not a legal or a compliance department law. GDPR requires you to implement information governance, information models. It requires you to come up with personal information registration administration with interface descriptions or whatnot. It actually requires you as a business to implement proper information architecture. So how does information architecture governance relate to legal compliance, or at least to the lawyer side of legal compliance? Well, it doesn't, because it just doesn't. So there are areas of business in which we've been doing this for quite some time, especially in the healthcare realm. And when you look at medicine manufacturing, for instance, in the early 20th century, there were a lot of medicines against the flu and against pneumonia, and essentially what these medicines did was not exactly cure the disease, but they made you die very happy, because they were primarily made out of morphine and alcohol, which is awesome, which makes you really warm and fluffy but still die. So what happened in the early 20th century in the healthcare realm was that they implemented laws requiring the so-called subsidiarity principle, which is a legal construct which says whatever you claim to be effective towards something must actually be proven to be effective towards that something. So the medical industry went like, shit, now we actually have to come up with something that works. And that took them about 100 years. And then they started to implement medical devices to help out, like pacemakers and insulin pumps and artificial lungs and stuff. And, well, with those instruments, it also helps if they actually do what they're supposed to do and not necessarily create cardiac arrests and whatnot. But now we have this new reality with the networked environment in healthcare, which also requires pacemakers to be, well, somewhat protected from, let's say, hacking, because, well, what's more easy for an assassin? Do you think it's more easy to go into a bush or something like from a kilometer's distance and have a big giant sniper rifle and then hoping that with the wind and the angles and everything you're able to hit your target? Or does it look more easy to simply walk towards his house, hack his Wi-Fi, overload his insulin pump and kill him like that? Personally, I would prefer the latter. But this implements, or at least this requires, the implementation of risk management, which means that you first have to know what the risks are of the product that you are trying to defend, then come up with requirements to mitigate those risks, then implement those requirements, and then actually test if those implemented requirements are indeed effective towards what you're trying to protect. So in the IT realm, this is something like the V model. There's different models, but this one is a very common part. So, like I said, general data protection regulation uses the same principle. Know what you have on the information side, know whoever is using or processing the information, and if you know those things, it's very easy, at least it's more or less doable, to provide the data owner with the rights, like access and portability, or to demand erasure. And the nice thing about the GDPR as well, and this is, I mean, there's all, if you hear this, then the whole power to the people premonition of the GDPR, that might suggest that the GDPR is an anti-company law. But it isn't, because companies now, for the first time in history, have one single go-to point regarding information, personal information security related stuff in the entire EU, instead of the 27 other pretty much disagreeing little parties which implemented their own version of this reality. Thank God the UK got out, because now it's one less, but still, the model is not very scalable. So what we're now coming up with in the EU cybersecurity realm is a EU-wide competence network. And the competence network's establishments at first are creating a common vocabulary. Because if you don't agree that you actually speak the same language, then it's very hard to even agree about anything else. And the same language doesn't necessarily mean the same linguistic language, like the spoken language, English or whatnot, but come up with definitions regarding scope, targets, measures, applicability, and whatnot. And this is something that's actually interesting, because the individual computer emergency response agencies within the member states, they used to all have a different definition of what is an IT incident. An IT incident in the Netherlands, for instance, if you are aware that the Netherlands is basically this swampy area surrounded by water, which mainly lays around 3 meters below sea level. Actually, my house in The Hague is 4.5 meters below sea level. In the Netherlands, a major IT incident would be not being able to reach the water level management facilities in my area. Yet, that type of IT-related incident might not be the same in, let's say, Austria, in the Alps, for reasons of not being underwater. So, first, we have to come up with a level of vocabulary. And then we have to upgrade. I deliberately don't say update, because we are taking a leap here. We need to upgrade security in education. The example given here, a PHP bit of crap, literally comes from an IT course from a University of Applied Science in the Netherlands. This is not unique for the Netherlands, and any of you who reads PHP will know instantly what's wrong with it, other than I've forgotten a couple of quotes here and there, but those are my typos. But the general principle is, let's say, input validation. So, in the past weeks, and this is really nice, the national news agencies in the Netherlands have had over 15 major news items about IT courses doing crap like this. Which, being an IT security teacher for several universities in the Netherlands, that makes my job security a lot better for now. But still, we have to update on this. So the focus for the next 2 years, which is coincidentally also the timeline for the implementation for the new EU Cybersecurity Act, will be to create at least some sense of security in education as well. So we have building block number one, create a common vocabulary. Building block number two, make sure that we educate people to actually know what they're talking about. And even better, first we educate the teachers so that they are able to educate pupils to actually know what they're talking about. And then we go into certification. And the certification hooks into the concept of the whole transparency aspect. So how can you give people the tools to actually assess whether if the product that they are using is in some way fit for purpose, including the security question? So you come up with certification, naturally. But certification has a pretty bad reputation, especially if you look at commercial IT certification realms, like certified secure by Norton Antivirus. This email is certified secure by Kaspersky, yet the Russian Secret Service is listening over your shoulder, but we don't tell anyone still. So what is, you first then have to come up with what your process of certification or evaluation towards certification would then be. And luckily, the beauty about standards and norms is that you have so many to choose from. We have the ISO 15408, which is evaluation criteria for IT security, which happens to be the norm that basically the Western world around 2000 adopted already as the common criteria, or actually the 15408 is the norm which allows you to evaluate if some party has implemented those common criteria correctly. And it is actually both as useful a guide for developers as well as for customers. I'm sorry, I have a terrible cough, so I keep switching off and on my microphone to try and prevent you from being blasted away by the coughing. So if I at some point forget, please forgive me. So when you introduce a concept in law and then you say it's voluntary, that usually causes some kind of friction, because voluntary laws, that kind of is a contradiction in terms. So what they've built in this particular realm is that they have a comply or explain principle, which means that you either adopt this norm or you have to explain for every little teeny tiny detail which is in the bloody norm, and those are a lot of pages, why you don't comply, and thereby making it effectively easier to do comply to the norm than to explain why you don't. So I'm going to go over the items of the ISO 15408, but I should indicate also that this is a norm that is free to download, free as in beer. Although I wouldn't recommend reading the norm whilst drinking beer, because it is quite a complex norm, and you have like this, the Balmer optimum of intoxication versus information processing, and that tends to go south quite easy. If you look at Windows Vista, we all know what that means. So I will go over the norm, but you are able to download it yourself from the ISO website, and it is, if you're used to reading technical requirements, specification, documentation, it's a surprisingly readable and practical norm. It's big. It is a couple of hundred pages, A4 size information, but that is not because it's so complex. It's just because it covers an immense amount of topics. So I will scan the surface here so that you at least have some clue as to the scope and coverage of this norm. But I would highly recommend you to download at least part one, which is the general model and introduction. And that gives you the impression of the scope and the idea in which this norm is applicable. Because again, this will be a voluntary law soon. So if you want to be able to market any kind of IT-related system or IoT-related system in any kind of regulated environment, that whole concept of voluntary may not be entirely applicable. So we have this concept called target of evaluation. That's the beginning. And the target of evaluation is not necessarily a single system. It is what we, in the architecture domain, referred to as an information domain. And an information domain is one or more systems or applications or parts of systems or applications that work with certain related information entities and are being used in a certain type of functionality. For instance, HR departments, if you would consider the HR process to be the target of evaluation, that would consist of both the HR registration with the names and addresses and dates of birth and whatnot. It would also include the financial processing information, because for some reason employees want to be paid. So if at least they don't work for free or voluntary, and you have a financial administration, you should consider that under the information domain, HR. So I hope that's clear. Information domain does not mean single application. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But this makes the concept a bit hard from a vendor perspective. I would even say almost impossible from a vendor perspective to claim that your application single application is always compliant to common criteria or ISO 15408, because from my point of view, and I will give an example later on, the only type of application that's actually, or system that's actually suitable to be an information domain by itself is an operating system, because that is a low-level, single-purpose, mostly type of thing to ensure that it serves other things. And we'll go into that later, but for instance, SUSE Linux Enterprise Server has been certified by the Bundesamt für Sicherheit und Informationstechnik, which is the German NSA. SUSE Linux Enterprise Server has been certified for ISO 15408 purpose as being a target of evaluation by itself. So this is a concept you should just internalize, and copy the list of whatever type of thing might be considered to be a target of evaluation. And a target of evaluation can also be a process. So targets of evaluation are also combinations of different assets. And assets can be systems, documentation, personnel even. And especially IT systems, as they are configurable, they might, in some configurations, not be suitable for usage in such a highly regulated environment. If you don't implement proper security controls like SA Linux or AppArmor, or to name just a couple of simple things, then it might be that that particular configuration is not applicable to be a target of evaluation. But still, just accept this as being reality. So the target audiences for the 15408 are consumers, because consumers can define requirements, what they would need from a security perspective in a target of evaluation or a system. And that's called a protection profile. So a protection profile could be, I have a firewall and that should prevent stuff from going in and out of my network without me explicitly telling anyone to do so. Developers, on the other hand, they develop the security target, which is supposed to be protected by the protection profile. So system target, or security target, the system, protection profile, the requirements of anything you want to impose on that system. And then you have the evaluators, which have the fun job of poking around to see if the protection profile is actually sufficient for the target, and then you have the rest of the world. So part one, like I said, is actually quite readable. It goes over how to come up with security requirements, so the process of requirements, elicitation, specification, validation, how to create protection profiles and packages of profiles, because you can reuse profiles across different targets of evaluation which have the same profile. I mean, if you create a profile for a firewall A, then you can probably reuse that profile for firewall B, and that's entirely legitimate. And chapter 9, or clause 9 in ISO terminology, is on how to handle evaluation results. And then we have a couple of annexes which go into detail of what it is. So chapter 7, how to come up with requirements, how to define them, how to create a terminology and use the terms appropriately for the requirements. Chapter 8, come up with profiles and packages. And here again, the example of the firewall. For instance, I have an IP tables firewall, and that should do whatever every other firewall should do as well. So then I have a protection profile for a firewall, and the security target in this instance will be the IP tables firewall. And then we have the evaluated results, and the nice thing about that is the purpose of the common criteria is not only to evaluate, but also to communicate those results. So, for instance, the SUSE validation, SUSE Linux Enterprise Server validation, that is the result of that. The report is online in its entirety. So you can access the report and see how SUSE prepared itself for this certification process. You can also see which parts they included in it and which parts they didn't. So the scope of part one is mainly background information. Part two is towards what kind of requirements do we have, and part three is what kind of assurances can we implement so that the requirements are met. So then you look at assets and environment, and anyone who's familiar with IT security, especially ISO 27001, will have heard about the concept of assets and environment, because an asset is something you want to protect. The environment is somewhere you want to protect the asset in, and then you create a risk profile of all the risks that the asset might be exposed to within the environment. And assets can be everything. Even I can be an asset if I want to be. Actually, for my own company, I am an asset. The rest of the world might think differently, by the way. That's their freedom. If you go into concepts and relationship, an owner wants to protect assets, will take countermeasures to mitigate risks. A threat agent will try to impose those risks on the same assets, and that's how it all ties together. So the whole idea of the ISO 15408 is to demonstrate applicability, appropriateness, subsidiarity, if you will, effectiveness, to define the fitness, demonstrate the fitness for purpose of the measures that you take on security. So, because if something is not interesting for you to consider to be a risk, then you don't have to do anything against it. So the whole process of risk assessment is not just coming up with as many hypothetical scenarios as possible in which something can go wrong. No, it must be in some way related to any reality that you feel yourself into. So, evaluation gives you confidence that the countermeasures that you take are sufficient, are correct, to mitigate the risk that is exposing your assets. So then we have part two, which goes into the functional components and the requirements. Again, I've just outlined the basic steps or the basic concepts here. Coming up with requirements towards a security target, creating a protection profile, and it will create what's called security functional requirements. If you are an IT architecture student or IT student in general, developer, then you will note that security requirements are mostly regarded as being non-functional requirements. For instance, the IEEE norm of software requirements specification explicitly names security requirements to be non-functional requirements. So what does the ISO 15408 mean here? They mean that security functional requirements are basically the security access and authorization and authentication measures built into a system or into a target of evaluation. So not necessarily the security requirements on the physical environment or the operational environment of, let's say, a system administrator. Like, I have to keep my copies of the installation media absolutely secret because else someone else will steal them. It means that this is whatever you can configure inside a system as being a security measure. And that means usually authorizations. So then you can come up with a policy. And the policy is the part where you link the requirements to the actual procedure in which the system is used. And then you combine them into target of evaluation, security functionality, which is the matrix in which they tie together. So the objects of relevance here are usually users. Users want to access information. That information is being categorized in objects. A user has a session in which it will interact with the system, and to facilitate that system, that session, there will be resources available, like a server, a network, or whatnot, to facilitate that. And then, within those concepts, you will have certain attributes. For instance, this user has this profile, this security clearance, so therefore they may have this role in the system, etc. This basically sounds like a simple explanation of role-based access control outlining, because it's even not that much more. And this model defines a distinction between security functionality data, which is that side, which consists of the user attributes, which consists of access control and information attributes, and user data, which basically is the data of the system itself, so the workflow processing data. So security-related data is metadata, and the rest is system data. So part two has the following chapters. Which requirements should be imposed on security audits? What can we audit on communications? Does cryptography play a role in there? How do we protect the actual data of the system? How do we go about identification and authentication, multiple factor authentication, for instance? What is our security management scheme? How do we go about privacy, etc., etc.? And then we have part three, which first we created all the requirements, the security requirements, and part three of the norm goes into how can we then come up with assurances that provide the required level of certainty that we need. And, well, you have to think in vulnerability management, because the thing that you are trying to prevent are vulnerabilities from being exploited. And vulnerabilities can come from a number of sources, i.e. the requirements of a system have been so poorly described that the business process will not be able to be facilitated. That is a vulnerability. Development is performed poorly, or the operations of a system are not implemented correctly and therefore leaving open all kinds of security holes. Vulnerability management you can do on a certain on certain levels. You can either eliminate the vulnerability, minimize the impact of the vulnerability, or monitor the vulnerability occurring so that you can then take action. Oh, by the way, I'm going through this quite fast, but the slides will be online if anyone is interested. And then how do you go about approaching evaluation? Well, you can simply analyze a process and procedure. You can do penetration testing. You can implement planning and control cycles to come up with it. And then you determine what kind of assurance level that you need to adhere to from a certain system. For instance, if you implement a healthcare-related system, from start to finish, you need to know what's going on there. So you will need to come up with assurance requirements describing in detail all the different parts of the system, and you have to choose a level that is appropriate for the target of evaluation that you want to protect. And in the last part, for instance, let's say functionally tested means I have my senior user group walking through all the procedures as soon as I have a new release. Structurally tested means I add automated testing. Methodically tested and checked is a formal process in which tests are being validated, etc., etc. In the norm, there are several of these matrices going into this. I'm wrapping up due to time. This is the chapters and the clauses which are outlined in part three, which give you input for that. And as open source community, I think we should start preparing for this, because this will be what will be required from users that want to use our systems in the nearby future. So we should think about coming up with protection packages and protection profiles and maybe standardized community efforts to create such profiles. Because just as the GDPR, free and open source software are not developed in a vacuum. They are developed in a virtualized environment, but still they are, we need to be law-abiding citizens. So communities, we need to start, because we can also benefit from this. Because being open source, being transparent, means that we, as part of our ecosystem, can actually be completely and brutally honest about what we do. And this is a big plus for businesses that are actually be able to contribute back to us by means of those validation packages, just like the end user now helps us with documentation and testing and whatnot. So if you have time, look into the use case of SUSE. It's on the website of SUSE. They have a nice report of everything they've done to ascertain the certification. And basically, this is what we should do better, as I just outlined. And I want to end with a very happy picture, because it is a very happy ending, I would say. And I'm even somewhat on time. So, who's still awake? Sweet. I'm not sure if I have time for questions, or if you're even still able to formulate some questions. Yes? Who dares? I will take this as a sign that I have been absolutely clear on this topic, and that you have been sufficiently informed. So thank you very much for your presence and awareness here, and I look forward to having some beers with you, because that is actually my next purposeful goal for today. All right, enjoy.